Spirit Radio Podcasts.
And joined with me on the line for this week's Home and Lifestyle Tips, I have the one and only Therese Davey. As always, Therese, you've come up with some very practical things for us to be thinking about this week.
The family jewels, Wendy. Good morning.
As opposed to the crown jewels.
Absolutely. And everyone has a family jewel, and it doesn't have to be valuable. It's sentimental. I have my grandfather's and great-grandfather's broken watches. I have my grandmother's and great-grandmother's wedding bands, do you know? And they're not a huge value to anyone else.
But the sentimental value is, you can't put a value on it, basically.
No, I have them, and I gave mum's wedding band to my niece. So it's about having something to pass on like that and keeping them safe and keeping them clean and knowing where they are. And it doesn't have to be a crown jewel. It can be just something that's important and sentimental to you and your family. But first thing you got to know, you got to find out their value. Are they insured? Do you actually know where they are? And have you photographed them? Now, I made the mistake. I can't find the photographs of things that I have. And something was stolen from the car, so I have no record of it. So that's what I'm telling people. Find what you have. Know where they are. Know where that watch chain is or that broken watch your grandfather had. Photograph it. Is it kept safe? Do you have the certificate and the insurance cert for your own engagement ring? Is it in that fireproof box that you all bought in Aldi when I said they were there? And have you got them safe? And are they insured? And check your insurance policy to see what's the limit, or is there an individual limit for certain items, and do you need to mention it individually, like your engagement ring or like some other thing that you have? Does it have to be listed, and do they need to know about it in particular? So there's a couple of jobs of the week. Find, photograph, record, and check and see are they in good repair.
Okay, so once we do that, because I know that my husband and mother would be laughing now, Therese, because I, for example, have a watch that is insured, that I lose all the time, and they're always giving out to me about it. Okay, so once we find them and we do our little inventory, obviously there's then the looking after of jewellery. I mean, I can't remember the last time I cleaned my wedding ring, for example.
Absolutely, and you've got to be careful with cleaning your jewellery. But if it needs to be, take a look at it first and see if it is in good repair. Aren't the claws tight on all the stones in that granny's ring or that ring you bought in a junk shop somewhere that you really love? And is it in good repair? And get it professionally repaired if it needs it. But do check and research your jeweller before you hand over your prized possession. But cleaning the jewellery, and everyone says, that's only a toothbrush and a bit of fairy liquid. It's true, but there are other ways of doing it. Platinum, you buy a platinum cleaning cloth, and you buy that online. Easy peasy. Silver, if they've got a huge build-up of tarnish, out comes the... Guess what comes out of the cupboard, Wendy?
Go on, give us a hint.
The bread soda. Out comes the bread soda.
Our good old friend bread soda. Is there anything that lemon and bread soda can't clean?
Exactly. The bread soda comes out and you get your water and mix it together, make a paste, and very, very gently rub, you rinse, and then you buff dry. Same with some gold jewellery. You can do the same with the bread soda and a little bit of vinegar this time. But please, please, please be very careful using any kind of solution or any kind of cleanser on pearls or gemstones or anything else like that, because you can damage their finish. You can actually split semi-precious stones by putting them in boiling water, or you might even loosen the glue. Sometimes they're held together with glue. Ketchup. Did you ever hear of using ketchup?
I definitely haven't heard of that. Go on, what's the science behind that stuff?
Saw it online, saw a girl do it online. I watched a video this morning, and she was cleaning all her cosmetic jewellery from Primark, as she called it, in ketchup, and it really did work. She said, don't dump them because they look tarnished. Try a bit of cleaning first, and she put a chain into ketchup, and it worked. But you can also clean silver in ketchup, and you use an old toothbrush to get into the crevices. But please don't leave it in too long, because I think it's the vinegar and the chemicals in the tomatoes and things that combine that is the cleansing agent there. But you need, as always, rinse, rinse, rinse very well. Soak your diamonds in whole loads of things to make them clean, and rubies and sapphires if you're blessed to have them. Sparkling club soda, denture tablets, vodka, gin, toothpaste, all those things will cling all those stones very gently. And if you're using a toothbrush, please use a very, very, very soft or old one, or ideally a baby brush. And I saw another video recently with a jeweller, and he dried them with the hairdryer just to get behind them, to dry them properly and quickly. I thought that was clever too. And he was a professional jeweller. It was very interesting to watch him do that. Gold. Now, this is an interesting one too. Beer.
All righty.
The bottom of that glass, when there's people over, keep that tiny little drop, the tiny drop in the can. Not brown beer, not dark stuff, but bright, but lager, I assume. And once again, a little bit of soft cloth rub all over, rinse well and dry. But be careful when you're washing or cleansing things. I nearly lost my engagement ring on the honeymoon down the drain of a sink abroad because of larger sinkholes. And the rings have never come off my hand since. But just be careful when you're washing things like that. Do it in a basin, never in the sink, because things can fall down the sink. And you never know what the sink, little gratings, how wide they are. And they can just get down there. And you do not want to be chasing down drains after your rings. Do you, Wendy?
Definitely not.
And finally, the other one is pearls.
And I don't have any pearls, but Monday maybe I'll get some. Valentine's Day is coming up, you know.
My husband was away off somewhere foreign, and they were very reasonable because they made them to order, and he had a bit of string that was tied to my wrist and everything. And he was very good, and I got this beautiful present. But you've got to be very careful with them and cleaning them. Immersing them in liquid you never do, because it weakens the strings. What you do is you wipe with a slightly wet cloth soaked in a tiny bit of detergent, and you wipe each pearl individually and you dry them individually, and you always store them in a soft cloth purse or anything, you know, the kind of little jewellery sacks you have, that you keep them together like that. The strings do deteriorate and you don't want them to break when you're out on the dance floor at a wedding, so check them before you put them on and get them restrung if they're valuable or real sentimental value. Rather than losing them, it's worth getting it done. And never spray perfume on after you put on your pearls. I remember I lost one hoop pearl earring because I didn't put one of those, you know, the little plastic catches you get for the back of hoop earrings. You get them in Claire's Accessories. If you have hoop earrings that you like and there's no catch on the back of them, please go in to an accessory shop and buy those little plastic catches. Don't lose your earring like that, me, because I think I was putting on a scarf and I knocked it off. So be careful with that. But at the weekend, I found in Eurosaver, they have a cleansing baths that you put your jewellery on a little tray, drop it into it and leave it for a few minutes. And they're only £1.50 in Eurosaver. I paid £6 sterling for one of those many years ago. So that was a great find. I bought another one. They're great and dead handy. But please, please be careful. Rinse everything properly when you take them out of those cleaning baths. And never, ever put enamel. I had a friend who lost an enamel off an old chain she had. She dropped it in and forgot she had it in the cleanser, and came back 2 days later and all the enamel had eroded off. So please be careful with those jewellery cleansers, or those liquid cleansers, because they're very strong. And rinse. Please always remember to rinse. But one other thing before I leave. Have you odd earrings in the bottom of a box?
Oh, definitely. Earrings and cufflinks are the things in our house that there's only one of each.
Well, I had a friend who brought them to a craft jeweller, and she got a brooch or a pendant. It was a brooch that could become a pendant at the same time. She bought the chain later. And she got the craft jeweller to make up a piece for her using all her odd little earrings, gold and silver earrings, and it was lovely. So if you know of a craft jeweller in your area, and go bring them along and ask them, would they do something with them? Don't waste them. Don't have them on the bottom of the box, particularly if you got them as a present and you enjoyed them and someone gave them to you that was special. Get them reassembled. Or what's more, how about giving a big hint to the other half in your life that maybe they might go off and get it done for you? How about that, Wendy?
Very good. I like that idea, Therese, that's for sure.
Job of the week.
Oh, I thought we were going to get away without it.
Yeah, job of the week. Major hints to the loved one that I heard this on the radio today. You could get these something repaired or remade with all the odd bits. And, you know, they're here, dear. They're here. You know, that could be your job of the week. Drop hints.
No, thanks.
Get your jewellery redone.
Okay, give us an easy one then. Come on, ease us into it.
Easy one of the week. I think you should go back to the back of the boot of the car.
Okay.
That's my job of the week. I'm setting that for my target for the week. Go back to the boot of the car and see what's in there, and check underneath the bottom where your tyre is, because I found some interesting things that had fallen down there. So clean the boot of your car is your easy peasy job of the week this week, and make sure you have the sprays for the frosty things.
All right, I can deal with that.
And in Euros, but in the Euro shop also, something to put into the boot of your car. The cover in the window I was talking about a couple of weeks ago that saved me defrosting. Euro Saver shop has them for £150, which is half the price I paid for them in Asda. But they're dead handy. They don't take up much room, and it saves you defrosting on the frosty mornings. So there's your job of the week, the boot.
All right, done. Therese, as always, thanks so much for joining us on the programme this morning. Not too bad of a job of the week. I can live with that. We'll talk to you the same time next week. We're now in the end game, in the high stakes game of poker, really, between the UK and the European Union. And many people would argue that. Is this a game of poker face? Who is going to blink first? It's now less than 50 days before the UK are due to cease being members of the European Union. Now, British PM Theresa May has been told by her parliament that what the EU has offered in the withdrawal agreement is not nearly good enough. So what the question is what is going to happen next? Are we going to end up with a crash out? And who will suffer most if this happens? Well, our next guest believes that the EU is in a more perilous position than it might want to admit, and that they would be well advised to offer more palatable terms to the UK to avoid tipping not just the UK and indeed Ireland, but the whole union into an economic crisis. In the studio now, we have UCD Professor Ray Kensland. He's also the author of Troikonomics, Austerity, Autonomy and an Existential Crisis in the European Union. Ray, good morning to you.
Good morning, Melody.
I hate to be so doom and gloom on a Monday morning, but where are we at now in terms of the negotiations with the UK and the EU?
We're in a wasteland because we have weeks to go, we have nothing agreed, and we have an adversarial relationship between the UK and Europe, or more specifically between Donald Tusk and Theresa May. It was very interesting, a few days ago Donald Tusk used a phrase which we'd heard before from the States, but which I think conveyed very vividly just how bad things are, when he said there is a special place in hell for those who support Brexit without a plan. I mean, that's most unusual language to use, particularly at a time like this. So we're in a very perilous position. It's not just that there's nothing being agreed, it's that there is bad relationships between the two entities. There's a divide of British politics and indeed in the north of Ireland. And, I mean, bringing it down to practicalities, Wendy, there are ships ready to set sail with cargoes that will take weeks to reach their destination, and not knowing what the status of trade relationships under which they operate are.
It's just one example of the basically so many different industries and people and individuals feeling their way around in the dark, which kind of seems to be similar for what's happening between the UK and the EU. What's going to happen next, Ray, or what can happen next? What are the possible outcomes?
Well, there are there is a timetable. Theresa May will speak later this week on Wednesday, and she'll present a plan B, maybe an amended slightly form of what was emphatically rejected by the Commons, and then there'll be a debate in the Commons looking at possible options that may or may not exist.
But can anything new be debated and discussed that hasn't already happened?
Probably not. I think what the Commons will be looking to say would be there are a large number of people who would be concerned across parties at having a no deal Brexit arrangement, and there may be some thought of a cross party agreement on deciding that won't happen, and maybe mandating a committee of all party committees to look for some kind of change in the backstop. The whole system, the whole chaos that exists is, as I said, it's reminiscent of a very bad relationship, a relationship that starts off well, but clearly where you have two parties who are in different trajectories. And I think it's a particularly dangerous game, Wendy, because during the Great Crisis, we were well used to late-night sittings and crisis meetings and eurozones and, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning agreements. This is quite different. It has a different feel about it. And it may well be that the EU's negotiating tactic is to let it go down to the wire, not to blink. I mean, that would do two things. It might well force the UK to concede on what was originally agreed, and it would certainly send a message to other countries. There is a spurious kind of unity in Europe at the moment. Everybody's whipped into line, but Europe is concerned that if the UK leaves, what Europe has become, and I choose my words carefully there, because there was a time when Europe was sunlit pastures and where people were really positive. Europe is in a different, completely different position now. But the overriding fear is that if they concede at all to Britain, well, then they'll all be doing it.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, as you touched on before, nobody's asked the question, why has this situation come about in the first place? You know, what's the kind of root of it? But in terms of the economics of it all, right, and I know it's very hard to predict because we don't know what's going to happen, but even that in itself has an economic impact, is the uncertainty of it all.
Well, that's true, and you can see that coming out at a number of levels. You can see it in the decisions taken by some very large firms and some very large banks who said basically we can't wait, and they've relocated. You can also see it intriguingly in the decisions that some very large firms have made to report a possible underachieving of their profit targets of a couple of months ago. Wall Street is definitely getting concerned at the impact it may have. And of course, the big international agencies like the IMF have indicated that it will have a negative effect at numerous levels, Wendy. It's not just growth, it's not just exports, it's the whole value chain that is a very complicated structure across different countries where goods are made from different bits and pieces. But there is behind all this, there is, and we use that in the book to which you referred, this is really a crisis about autonomy versus hegemony. Is it a good thing that nations make their own decisions for areas for which they're responsible to their people? Is it a good thing that Europe is becoming more and more hegemonized?
And that's what some people find the frustration with, and that's certainly one of the reasons we're having this conversation. You believe that Brexit is the canary in the UK coal mine. Is it because of this kind of, change of some countries feeling they have a loss of autonomy over this kind of hegemonist, I don't know how to say that, nature of the European Union, where they feel, you know,
I think you have it absolutely right. There are parallels in the case of Greece, for example. And remember, Greece was only a few years ago where Greece had got a mandate to renegotiate its debt, and where Europe just wasn't interested, and they said, we will close the banks unless you agree. And in the book, we have a chapter that looks at Greece, and that was an extraordinary suppression of democracy at every level, where a small group of unaccountable individuals, to which there was no appeal, decided on the political as well as the economic emasculation of a country in real trouble. Now, you don't have to push it that far. All you have to do is to say, even though you're dealing with a much larger economy here, Europe has lost the sense of what it was originally about. It's now moving towards a much more concentrated political entity, where basically in a recent treaty, France and Germany decided things. And I can remember making this point before here, Wendy. What does concern me is the direction in which we're going. Europe has lost the sense of identity with its roots. And remember, in Germany, for example, the Christian Democrats were what brought stability to Germany and stability to Europe. That's been pushed out now. So the existential crisis we talk about is, look at Italy and the insistence on by Europe that they renegotiate a budget which was planned to alleviate poverty and real distress in Italy. You look at the migration crisis, which is still horrific for families. That hasn't been resolved. You look at the militarization campaign to build up a European army. All these are signs of this existential strain. And it may well be that it's more convenient for Europe to allow the clock to run down and to allow Britain to enter a period of stasis.
What should Ireland do? What should the Irish government be doing?
Well, one of the great myths is that in following the course of events that it has, that Britain is yearning for an empire or its empire back. That is sheer nonsense. Britain was never comfortable in Europe. And I've had many chats with colleagues of mine in Britain about this. They've never really been comfortable in Europe. That said, despite all the froth and all the division, there was a decision taken by the British people to exit. There was a commitment there. And that commitment needs to be honoured and needs to be respected. It's clear that Europe really doesn't do that. I mean, in our own case in Ireland, in both Nice and Lisbon, and remember, Lisbon was less than 10 years ago, it was vote again and get the right decision. We have a dependent relationship now with Britain. The kind of national aspirations and responsibilities that shaped the early Irish idea of self, that has been replaced by a very close dependency by the Irish elite on Europe. It's better that way, they feel more comfortable. But it does leave us terribly exposed if and when Britain does exit in some form or other, because far from being the centrepiece of action, Ireland would be peripheral, dependent in Europe, that has lots of other different things to do.
Are we doing enough at this point in time, knowing that these are a risk coming down the line, to try and mitigate against that for Ireland's perspective?
Well, Ireland's always been very comfortable with Europe. And again, I can think back on the different levels towards which we move towards Europe. Irish people are very comfortable abroad. But that by itself doesn't stand. We need to be seeing that we're also directly adjoining Britain. We share a land border with Britain. Ireland's got a long history. It's got a very strong economic process of integration with Britain. And I suppose what many people would be saying, of course, we are comfortable in Europe, but we are against seeing the linkages between Ireland and Britain being severed when we could have done much more in terms of the backstop. If, for example, and in the end, it will come down to some form of technological agreement to monitor and keep track of trade. And why wouldn't it? I mean, we do not need, it's one of the great myths, we do not need hard infrastructure with soldiers at the border. Technology can deliver solutions. But we haven't gone that way. We have preferred to shelter behind Europe. And I don't think that's a wise thing to do. I think a country should be able to stand on its own feet, but it should have regard to relationships that we have with our closest neighbour. We should have worked with the UK much more closely. The fact that we didn't is partly due to the fact that, frankly, the UK were wholly inept in the way they approach things. So where we are at the moment, Wendy, it's the implacable EU against the totally inept UK. And it matters what happens.
Sure does. Well, not long to go now, just 50 days. Thanks for joining me in studio. I've been chatting to Professor Ray Kinsella. He's the author of Troikonomics alongside Dr. Maurice Kinsella. It's Austerity, Autonomy and the Existential Crisis in the European Union. Ray, thanks for joining us as always on Spirit Radio this morning. Well, some great news for type 1 diabetes sufferers, because a California-based medical devices company has developed, get this, an artificial pancreas, or a closed-loop system, which basically monitors 24/7 your glucose levels and automatically delivers exactly the right amount of insulin. On the line from California to tell us more, we have Lou Lintcher, a senior engineer who's part of the team that developed this artificial pancreas. Lou, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Lou. I believe that you worked for NASA previously and you're an engineer. Tell us more about your background.
Yeah, so I currently work for Medtronic Diabetes, but I didn't actually start out in medical technology. My degrees are in aerospace engineering, and so coming out of school, graduate school, actually the first half of my career was in aerospace. So I worked for a company called Hughes Space and Communications. We designed and developed communication satellites, things like DirecTV, if you have that, out in Ireland. Then I went out and worked for NASA, currently the Armstrong Flight Research Center in Edwards Air Force Base in Southern California. I worked there for about 6 years. Then I made a switch to medical technology for a variety of reasons, but I landed with a company called Advanced Bionics, and we made cochlear implants for people who are profoundly deaf. And finally, I was recruited to come work for Medtronic Diabetes, actually largely because of my background in aerospace and in control systems, to work on this what became artificial pancreas development, but we like to call it our closed-loop systems.
So tell us a little bit about, first of all, I think before we go into this closed-loop system, what is the function of the pancreas? Why do we need it to work?
Well, the pancreas produces several important hormones that regulate different metabolic processes in the body. So probably the most important hormone it produces is a hormone called insulin. And insulin is used to regulate our blood sugar. Our blood sugar likes to be at a certain level throughout the day and night. After meals, of course, it generally goes up as your body digests food, and then your pancreas releases insulin to try to bring it back down to that normal level. And if your pancreas does not work properly, it cannot produce this hormone, and your blood sugar will rise out of control, and that leads to long-term health death if not treated. But certainly, even if treated and your blood sugar remains high, can lead to long-term health consequences. And of course, this disorder is called type 1 diabetes.
And in terms of type 1 diabetes and just the impact that can have, if it's not managed properly, it can, of course, be detrimental.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, if not treated, it will lead to death. Miraculously, insulin was discovered, and we were able to treat it. But the treatment was very crude in the original early years, and blood sugar, like I said, would remain quite high not in very good control. And so people would live, but they would suffer long-term consequences, things like blindness, heart disease. They'd have nerve problems. Oftentimes people have to get amputations. It was very ugly, but again, at least they were alive. And over the years, the technology has advanced to where we've been able to achieve a much more accurate blood sugar control, to the point now to where people are leading very healthy lives into old age with very few complications. And especially with our closed loop systems, we've been able to achieve control that would have been unheard of even 5 or 10 years ago.
So explain then the closed loop system. How does it work, and what sort of a difference does it make to somebody who has type 1 diabetes?
So the closed loop system that we have developed, it's called our Medtronic 670G system. And what it does is it uses a blood glucose sensor that is attached to the body, and the blood glucose sensor measures your blood glucose about every 5 minutes. And that 5 minute measurement is transmitted wirelessly to an insulin pump, which runs this closed loop algorithm. And the algorithm then takes that blood glucose measurement and determines whether it's high or low, whether it's rising or falling, and using that information determines how much insulin it should give you in that 5 minute period to bring your blood sugar back to normal. And it works quite well. And people who have diabetes today who have used the system have noticed a large increase in their time in the normal blood glucose range compared to when they were on their previous therapy, even if it was another insulin pump or sometimes multiple daily injections. They notice a time and range getting close to 70%, which doesn't sound like much, but people who came from previous therapies would get a time and range of maybe 40, 50, 60%. That would be a typical time and range, certainly for somebody on multiple daily injections.
And so in terms of finding the right candidates for this closed-loop system, how does that work?
Well, it's quite simple, really. If you are over the age of 6 years old and you have type 1 diabetes, you're a candidate. So that's pretty much it. There are a few restrictions, of course, like it's not labeled for women who are pregnant, for example. Typically, pregnant women like to be at a lower blood sugar than is achievable by this particular device, and so they have to manage their diabetes more intensively using more standard therapies. But other than that, it's pretty much 7 and up with type 1 diabetes and willing to calibrate a sensor and go through the activities needed to actually manage the system.
Is it possible for someone to have a pancreas transplant, Lou?
Pancreatic transplants are not really an option for people with type 1 diabetes. There is certainly research in not full pancreatic transplants, but what are called islet cell transplants. And these are the cells of the pancreas that actually produce the insulin. So, again, not the whole pancreas, but sometimes people can get a bundle of cells implanted into the pancreas, or even actually some of the research now into other parts of the body to produce insulin. The problem with those has been, though, that diabetes is a type of disease. It's called an autoimmune disease. So the reason people have diabetes is their own immune systems have attacked the cells of the pancreas that produce the insulin and kill them. So oftentimes what happens is, if you put those cells back in the body, your immune system wakes back up and kills them again. So that can be a problem. But there is research going on for a cure of these types of transplants to help kind of trick the immune system into not believing that these cells are bad for the body.
So in terms of, I suppose, efficacy, this closed-loop system it does better in terms of the success rate.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, we're achieving a time and range of that normal blood glucose of higher than it's ever been achieved before with any other type of therapy. So it's quite effective, and that time and range is linked to a key metric that doctors use to track the efficacy of diabetes or the efficacy of diabetes therapy, and that's a measurement called the A1C. And we're able to, for the first time ever in diabetes therapy, able to get people's average A1C down to below 7, which probably doesn't mean too much to your audience, but that's kind of a recognized threshold of good care by doctors.
And in terms of just the availability of this closed-loop system, is it available throughout the world, or, I mean, is this something that we can have here in Ireland?
Actually, we are in the process of launching this product in Ireland right now. So hopefully, if any of your audience has type 1 diabetes, they can start looking for this or asking their doctors about it. And because it should be available, if not today, in the very near future. It started out in the United States. It was launched there last year. It's done quite well in the United States. And only in the last, say, month have we started launching it across Europe and including Ireland.
So what are you working on at the moment, Lou? What's your next breakthrough?
Well, the next breakthroughs are advancements to the system. So we want to keep our lead in this closed-loop development. There's competition is coming, which is good, of course. But we want to keep our lead in the goodness of therapy. So we've made some improvements to the therapy that we will hopefully be launching in the next, say, 6 months in Europe, but not only that, but also usability improvements. So the system itself is actually quite easy to use, but it will sometimes give alerts if your blood sugar is trending low or trending high for too long. And these alerts can be annoying for some users, and so we've found that we can reduce the rate of alerts without compromising the safety, which makes for a much more pleasant user experience. And then we would like to also integrate things like Bluetooth into the devices themselves, so that you can hopefully one day control them from a phone.
Wow.
Instead of using, pushing buttons on your insulin pump. So those are the types of improvements we're looking for.
Controlling your pancreas from your smartphone. Who would have thought? It's truly incredible, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It sounds like people expect it these days to control everything through their smartphone, but when talking about a medical device where the risks are very high, we want to be very careful in that regard.
Sure. So a lot of research has to go into that. Lou, thanks so much for joining us on the program this morning. Really fascinating stuff. That's Lou Linter there, just talking about this closed loop system. We're kind of like an artificial pancreas and really helping people with type 1 diabetes. And as Lou mentioned, it's going to be available in Ireland. So I guess if you are a type 1 diabetes sufferer, the thing is you just kind of talk to your doctor about it and ask them what they know about it and would it be able to help you in your situation. Well, there's a really incredible event taking place at the RDS in Dublin this weekend for anybody who's interested in any element of performing arts, because there's just, I think, something for everybody, because there's 170 workshops, things like masterclasses, seminars. There's both local and international choreographers, voice coaches, actors, musicians, makeup artists. So as you can see, when we talk about performing arts, of course, the discipline is very, very broad. But there's lots of well-known stars as well that are going to be coming to Dublin from stage and screen. So former Pussycat Doll Kimberly Wyatt, Adam Garcia, you probably know him most recently from Got to Dance UK, Emily Barker from Dancing with the Stars Ireland, and YouTube sensation Christiana Bianco. She's an actor, singer and really, really good impressionist as well. And the festival is called Perform. In studio to tell us all about it, we have the creative director, I'm sure extremely busy at the moment, Alva O'Loughlin Kennedy. Alva, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So have you always been a performer?
I started in the amateur musical society circuit, which I think is where a lot of people start. Then I went into the kind of the corporate life and worked there, but continued on singing. So did a lot of different singing. I released a gospel album 10 years ago now.
Wow. We'll have to get you back on to sing some tracks from that album, that's for sure.
And I did a nationwide tour around Ireland called Go Light Your World, which was great fun. And then it just kind of transitioned, really. And so now I teach singing in different stage schools.
Fantastic stuff. And I have many happy memories of going to stage schools as a younger kid. Probably for me, I think it started in speech and drama class, and then like that amateur dramatics, all that sort of stuff. So that's the thing about this festival. You're probably going to have people who are professionals in different disciplines, but is it also for people who just love different elements, whether it's singing, whether it's acting, be it in a professional capacity or just as for fun, as a hobby?
Yeah, it's really open to everyone. So we have every level from beginner right up to professional. And it's even open to those who wouldn't consider themselves as performers necessarily, but would like to just try something new. I mean, we have belly dancing classes, we have Sosa Dance Fit, there's sing-alongs, there's entertainment going on throughout the day constantly on the main
stage. So it could be kind of a taster for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Who maybe are thinking of trying out a particular course. As you say, it could be belly dancing, it could be whatever.
It could be anything, yeah.
But they'll get a kind of a bit of a taster for it. So, but in terms of the idea, it's so broad, there's so much in it. Where did it come from?
With my teaching and teaching in different stage schools, in order to kind of develop my skills and to find out new ideas, I ended up going over to the UK because they have obviously a lot of different expos and they have different courses and that type of thing. And I was thinking to myself, there's nothing here that we have that same type of environment. So there's also a big dance show in the UK called Move It, which has been going about 10 years. And I had gone to that and I'd looked at that and I'd also been at various different drama and music expos. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be ideal if you could combine the two? And it's also a platform where all of the different groups from all of the different genres can perform and do workshops together, and they can all share ideas and, you know, inspire each other.
So there's going to be a lot of, I guess, opportunity for kind of creative coming together, and you never know kind of the relationships and friendships and all sorts of creative things that might happen. A lovely creative melting pot of things, which is brilliant as well. Okay, so let's say you've got somebody listening, maybe Alva, who they're intrigued by some of the workshops he's mentioned, or, you know, they've done a little bit of amateur dramatics or in a musical society. What sort of thing can they expect from the weekend?
They can expect, once they get their entry fee, so if they even didn't do any workshops, there is a huge amount of entertainment on the main stage with musical theatre, performances, bands, singers, dancers. Then we have a competition stage, and a dance competition stage, and a sing competition stage. The sing competition stage is basically get up and do some karaoke.
So you can just go to be entertained.
You just rock up on the day, you sign up, and you jump in, and you just take part, and you win some prizes. We have meet and greets, we have free seminars, and then we have all of the workshops as well that they can sign up to. So there's sing-alongs on the Sunday morning. There's the Kogo Travel Disney sing-along. They are giving away a trip to Disneyland Paris during that, which is quite exciting. Throughout the weekend, we also have scholarships to give away to dancers, to singers, for Institute of Arts Barcelona, the Hollywood tours in LA. So
are these people that are going to be showcasing their talent? Is there going to be kind of talent scouts there? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And then after, at 5 o'clock, when the exhibition closes to the public, we open up the studios then to the MGA Academy in Scotland, who will be holding auditions for their third level courses, and also to the entertainment group from the UK, who look after casting for entertainment jobs around the world.
Wow.
For professionals. So they'll be auditioning.
So it's a real opportunity as well for people who maybe they're at that point where they're thinking, gosh, maybe I have the talent to do this as a career, or they're already on that path, and it's just, you know, this melting pot of different you know, talent and casting directors, as you mentioned, from different backgrounds. Do you think this is something, an area that's kind of really growing in popularity in Ireland? Certainly when you think of performing arts, we really punch above our weight when you think of the size of our little country.
Yeah, I do. I think it suffered a little bit during the recession, because, you know, it is an extra spend for people, if, you know, to send their children to stage schools and that. But we, Ireland as a nation, are known as being highly talented people, right across the arts. And this weekend is going to showcase all of that. There is some incredible talent that's going to be on that stage, and some really creative pieces that I have seen, and I'm really excited.
It must make you very proud as well, because obviously, Alva, you had the idea, you were going to the UK, you were looking at what they do there and saying, can I bring it to Ireland? But as part of that, you've probably got to come into contact with so many different performing artists.
Yeah, it's. We would love to keep growing this each year. This is the first year that we've done it.
And it's huge for its first year.
It's huge already for the first year. I haven't slept much in the last.
Is that because when you kind of started the idea, just the demand, when
it's
you started
noble.
Putting the feelers out? Yeah,
it really did. You know, and we've had such a great reaction. We have Kian McCarthy coming home from New York. He's a musical director. He was originally from Cork, and he was one of the first people that we reached out to, and his response was, absolutely, I'm there. Ireland needs something like this, and I'm delighted that you're doing it. And that's the reaction that we've been getting, which is fantastic.
I think there certainly seems that spirit. There's so much Irish talent that's really successful in different areas overseas. Of course, we have an Oscar-nominated short film with The Detainment at the moment, but there's so many, that there's that feeling of, I want to come home and give back, I think, a lot of the time.
There
it's
is,
in our
yeah.
nature, which is lovely.
Yeah, it's super. It's great. And the Irish are super at that. They're great at that, at sharing and you know, getting together to inspire each other, you know.
Fantastic. It sounds like it's going to be a brilliant weekend. So do people turn up, or do you have to sign up for tickets? How does all that work, Alva?
The best way I would suggest is book online on performireland.ie. You can get your entry tickets there, and all of the workshops and everything that's going on, is all the information's up there, so you can then decide what workshops you want to do and what you want to plan out your itinerary for the weekend.
Great stuff. Well, I'm sure there's lots of people listening that will be very interested in going. And even here at Spirit Radio, we have plenty of musicians, actors who have both done these things professionally and in amateur ways. Well, so I think it's going to be a great weekend. So as Alva mentioned there, the best place to get all the info and all the different workshops and all that sort of stuff is the website performireland.ie. It's taking place this Friday, the 15th, to Sunday, the 17th of February, at the RDS in Dublin. It's Ireland's first performing arts festival, and as Alva mentioned, mentioned, it's just snowballed over 170 workshops, masterclasses, seminars, so much going on. So there's obviously a huge appetite for this and demand for this. So congratulations to you in
Thank
your
you
first year.
Much.
I'd say it'll only get bigger. I've been chatting to Alva O'Loughlin Kennedy.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.